Chapter 35. Nearly the end of our book. I had disrupted Jane Eyre quite considerably. My cry of Jane, Jane, Jane at her window had altered the book for good. It was against my training, against everything that I had sworn to uphold. I didn't see it as anything more than a simple act of contrition for what I felt was my responsibility over Rochester's wounds and the burning of Thornfield. I had acted out of compassion, not duty, and sometimes that is no bad thing. Thursday next, private diaries. At 3:05, I screeched to a halt outside the church of Our Blessed Lady of the Lobsters, much to the surprise of the photographer and the driver of the large Hispano-Suiza that was parked in readiness for the happy couple. I took a deep breath, paused to gather my thoughts, and, shaking slightly, walked up the steps to the main doors. The organ music was playing loudly, and my pace, which up to that point had been a run, suddenly slowed as my nerve abandoned me. What the hell was I playing at? Did I think I had any real chance of appearing from nowhere after a 10-year absence and then expecting the man I was once in love with just to drop everything and marry me? "Oh, yes," said a woman to her companion as they walked past me. "Landon and Daisy are so much in love." My walk slowed to a snail's pace as I found myself hoping to be too late and have the burden of decision taken from me. The church was full, and I slid unnoticed into the back, just next to the lobster-shaped font. I could see Landon and Daisy at the front, attended to by a small bevy of pages and bridesmaids. There were many uniformed guests in the small church, friends of Landon's from the Crimea. I could see someone whom I took to be Daisy's mother snivelling into her handkerchief, and her father looking impatiently at his watch. On Landon's side, his mother was on her own.
"I require and charge you both," the clergyman was saying, "that if either of you know any impediment why ye may not be lawfully joined together in matrimony, ye do now confess it."
He paused, and several guests shuffled. Mr. Mutler, whose lack of chin had been amply compensated by increased girth in his neck, seemed ill at ease, and looked about the church nervously. The clergyman turned to Landon and opened his mouth to speak, but as he did so, there came a loud, clear voice from the back of the church.
"The marriage cannot go on. I declare the existence of an impediment."
150 heads turned to see who the speaker was. One of Landon's friends laughed out loud. He obviously thought it was a joke. The speaker's countenance did not, however, look as though any humour was intended. Daisy's father was having none of it. Landon was a good catch for his daughter, and a small and tasteless joke was not going to delay her wedding.
"Proceed," he said,
his face like thunder. The clergyman looked at the speaker, then at Daisy and Landon, and finally at Mr. Mutler.
"I cannot proceed without some investigation into what has been asserted and evidence of its truth or falsehood," he said with a pained expression. Nothing like this had ever happened to him before.
Mr. Mutler had turned an unhealthy shade of crimson and might have struck the speaker had he been close enough.
"What is this nonsense?"
he shouted instead, setting the room buzzing.
"Not nonsense, sir,"
replied the speaker in a clear voice.
"Bigamy is hardly nonsense, I think, sir."
I stared at Landon, who looked confused at the turn of events. Was he married already? I couldn't believe it. I looked back at the speaker, and my heart missed a beat. It was Mr. Briggs, the solicitor I had last seen in the church at Thornfield. There was a rustle close by, and I turned to find Mrs. Nakajima standing next to me. She smiled and raised a finger to her lips. I frowned, and the clergyman spoke again.
"What is the nature of this impediment? Perhaps it may be got over, explained away."
Hardly, was the answer. I have called it insuperable, and I speak advisedly. It consists simply of a previous marriage.
Landon and Daisy looked at one another sharply.
Who the hell are you?
Asked Mr. Mutler, who seemed to be the only person galvanized into action.
My name is Briggs, a solicitor of Dash Street, London. Well, Mr. Briggs, perhaps you would be good enough to explain the previous marriage of Mr. Park Lane, so we may all know the extent of this man's cowardly action.
Briggs looked at Mr. Mutler, and then at the couple at the altar.
My information does not concern Mr. Park Lane. I am speaking of Miss Mutler, or, to give her her married name, Mrs. Daisy Posh.
There was a gasp from the congregation. Landon looked at Daisy, who threw her garland on the floor. One of the bridesmaids started to cry, and Mr. Mutler strode forward and took Daisy's arm.
Miss Mutler married Mr. Murray Posh on October the 20th, 1981,
yelled Mr. Briggs above the uproar.
The service was held at Southwark. There was no divorce petition filed.
It was enough for everyone. A clamour started up as the Mutler family beat a hasty retreat. The vicar offered an unheard-of prayer to no one in particular, as Landon took a much-needed seat on the pew that the Mutler family had just vacated. Someone yelled, "Gold digger!" from the back, and the Mutler family quickened their pace at the abuse that followed, much of which shouldn't have been heard in church. One of the pages tried to kiss a bridesmaid in the confusion and was slapped for his trouble. I leaned against the cool stone of the church and wiped the tears from my eyes. I know it was wrong of me, but I was laughing. Briggs stepped through the arguing guests and joined us, tipping his hat respectfully.
Good afternoon, Miss Next.
A very good afternoon, Mr. Briggs. What on earth are you doing here?
The Rochesters sent me.
But only left the book 3 hours ago. Mrs. Nakajima interrupted.
You left it barely 12 pages from the end. In that time, over 10 years have elapsed at Thornfield. Time enough for March planning.
Thornfield?
Rebuilt, yes. My husband retired, and he and I manage the house these days. None of us is mentioned in the book, and Mrs. Rochester aims to keep it that way. Much more pleasant than Osaka, and certainly more rewarding than the tourist business.
There didn't seem much I could say.
Mrs. Jane Rochester asked Mrs. Nakajima to bring me here to assist,
said Mr. Briggs simply.
She and Mr. Rochester were eager to help you as you helped them. They wish you all happiness and health for the future, and thank you for your timely intervention.
I smiled. How are they?
Oh, they're fine, miss, replied Briggs happily. Their firstborn is now 5. A fine, healthy boy, the image of his father. Jane produced a beautiful daughter this spring gone past. They have named her Helen Thursday Rochester.
I looked across at Landon, who was standing at the entrance to the church and trying to explain to his Aunt Ethel what was going on. I must speak to him. But I was talking to myself. Mrs. Nakajima and the solicitor had gone, melted back to Thornfield to report to Jane and Edward on a job well done. As I approached, Landon sat on the church steps, took out his carnation, and sniffed at it absently. Hello, Landon. Landon looked up and blinked.
Ah, he said. Thursday. I might have known.
May I join you?
Be my guest.
I sat down next to him on the warm limestone steps. He stared straight ahead.
Was this your doing?
He asked at last. No, indeed, I replied. I confess, I came here to interrupt the wedding, but my nerve failed me. He looked at me.
Why?
Why? Well, because... Because I thought I'd make a better Mrs. Park Lane than Daisy, I suppose.
I know that, exclaimed Landon, and agree wholeheartedly. What I wanted to know is why your nerve failed you. After all, you chase after master criminals, indulge in high-risk spec ops work, will quite happily go against orders to rescue comrades under an intense artillery barrage, yet...
I get the point. I don't know. Maybe those sorts of yes or no life and death decisions are easier to make because they are so black and white. I can cope with them because it's easier. Human emotions, well, they're just a fathomless collection of greys, and I don't do so well on the midtones.
Midtones is where I've lived for the past 10 years, Thursday.
I know, and I'm sorry. I had a lot of trouble reconciling what I felt for you and what I saw as your betrayal of Anton. It was an emotional tug of war, and I was the little pocket handkerchief in the middle, tied to the rope, not moving.
I loved him too, Thursday. He was the closest thing to a brother that I ever had. But I couldn't hang on to my end of the rope forever.
I left something behind in the Crimea, I murmured. But I think I've found it again. Is there time to try and make it all work?
Bit 11th hour, isn't it? He said with a grin.
No, I replied. More like 3 seconds to midnight. He kissed me gently on the lips. It felt warm and satisfying, like coming home to a roaring log fire after a long walk in the rain. My eyes welled up, and I sobbed quietly into his collar as he held me tightly.
"Excuse me," said the vicar, who had been lurking close by. "I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but I have another wedding to perform at 3:30.
We muttered our apologies and stood up. The wedding guests were still waiting for some sort of decision. Nearly all of them knew about Landon and me, and few, if any, thought Daisy a better match.
"Will you?" asked Landon in my ear.
"Will I what?"
I asked, stifling a giggle.
"Fool, will you marry me?"
I replied, heart thumping like the artillery in the Crimea. "I'll have to think about it."
Landon raised a quizzical eyebrow.
"Yes, yes, yes, I will with all my heart."
"At last," said Landon with a sigh. "The lengths I have to go to get the woman I love."
We kissed again, but for longer this time. So long, in fact, that the vicar, still staring at his watch, had to tap Landon on the shoulder.
"Thank you for the rehearsal," said Landon, shaking the vicar vigorously by the hand. "We'll be back in a month's time for the real thing."
The vicar shrugged. This was fast becoming the most ludicrous wedding of his career.
"Friends," announced Landon to the remaining guests, "I would like to announce the engagement of myself to this lovely spec ops agent named Thursday Next. As you know, she and I have had our differences in the past, but they are now quite forgotten. There is a marquee at my house stuffed with food and drink, and I understand Holroyd Wilson will be playing from 6 o'clock onward. It would be a crime to waste it all, so I suggest we just change the reason."
There was an excited yell from the guests as they started to organize transport for themselves. Landon and I went in my car, but we drove the long way round. We had plenty to talk about, and the party, well, it could continue without us for a while. The celebrations didn't finish until 4 a.m. I drank too much and took a cab back to the hotel. Landon was all for me staying the night, but I told him, slightly coquettishly, that he could wait until after the wedding. I vaguely remember getting back to my hotel room, but nothing else. It was blackness until the phone rang at 9 the following morning. I was half-dressed, Pickwick was watching breakfast TV, and my head ached like it was fit to burst. It was Victor. He didn't sound in a terribly good mood, but politeness was one of his stronger points. He asked me how I was. I looked at the alarm clock as a hammer banged inside my head. I've been better. How are things at work?
Not brilliant,
replied Victor, with a certain reserve in his voice.
The Goliath Corporation want to speak to you about Jack's shit, and the Bronte Federation are hopping mad over the damage to the book. Was it absolutely necessary to burn Thornfield to the ground?
That was Hades.
And Rochester, blinded and with a shattered hand. I suppose that was Hades too.
Well, yes.
This is the mother of all balls-ups, Thursday. You'd better come in and explain yourself to these Bronte people. I've got their special executive committee with me, and they are not here to pin a medal on your chest.
There was a knock at the door. I told Victor I would be in directly, and got unsteadily to my feet. Hello? I called out.
Room service,
replied a voice outside the door.
And Mr. Park Lane rang in some coffee for you.
Hang on, I said, as I tried to shoo Pickwick back into the bathroom. The hotel had strict rules about pets. Unusually for him, he seemed slightly aggressive. If he had possessed any wings, he would probably have flapped them angrily.
This is no time to be a pest,
I grunted, as I pushed the recalcitrant bird into the bathroom and locked the door. I held my head for a moment as it thumped painfully, wrapped myself in a dressing gown, and opened the door. Big mistake. There was a waiter there, but he wasn't alone. As soon as the door was fully open, two other men in dark suits entered and pressed me against the wall with a gun to my head.
You're going to need another two cups if you want to join me for coffee, I groaned.
Very funny, said the man dressed as the waiter.
Goliath, in one.
He pulled back the hammer on the revolver.
Gloves are off next. Shit is an important man, and we need to know where he is. National security in the Crimea depend upon it, and one lousy officer's life isn't worth diddly shit when you look at the big picture.
I'll take you to him, I gasped, trying to give myself some breathing space. It's a little way out of town. The Goliath agent relaxed his grip and told me to get dressed. A few minutes later, we were walking out of the hotel. My head was still sore, and a dull pain thumped in my temples, but at least I was thinking more clearly. There was a small crowd ahead of me, and I was delighted to see it was the Mutler family preparing to return to London. Daisy was arguing with her father, and Mrs. Mutler was shaking her head wearily.
Gold digger! I yelled.
Daisy and her father stopped arguing and looked at me as the Goliath men tried to steer me past.
What did you say?
You heard. I can't think who the bigger tart is, your daughter or your wife.
It had the desired effect. Mr. Mutler turned an odd shade of crimson and threw a fist in my direction. I ducked, and the blow struck one of the Goliath men fairly and squarely on the jaw. I bolted for the car park. A shot whistled over my shoulder. I jinked and stepped into the road as a big black military-style Ford motor car screeched to a halt.
Get in!
Shouted the driver. I didn't need to be asked twice. I jumped in and the Ford sped off as two bullet holes appeared in the rear windshield. The car screeched around the corner and was soon out of range.
Thanks, I murmured. Any later, and I might have been worm food. Can you drop me at Spec Ops HQ?
The driver didn't say anything. There was a glass partition between me and him, and all of a sudden I had that out of the frying pan and into the fire feeling.
You can drop me anywhere, I said.
He didn't answer. I tried the door handles, but they were locked. I thumped on the glass, but he ignored me. We drove past the Spec Ops building and headed off to the old town. He was driving fast, too. Twice he went through a red light, and once he cut up a bus. I was thrown against the door as he flew around a corner, just missing a brewer's dray.
Here, stop this car!
I shouted, banging again on the glass partition. The driver simply accelerated, clipping another car as he took a corner a little too fast. I pulled hard at the door handles and was about to use my heels against the window when the car abruptly screeched to a halt. I slid off the seat and collapsed in a heap in the footwell. The driver got out, opened the door for me, and said,
"There you go, missy. Didn't want you to be late. Colonel Phelps's orders."
"Colonel Phelps?" I stammered. The driver smiled and saluted briskly as the penny dropped. Phelps had said he would send a car for me to appear at his talk. And he had. I looked out of the door. We had pulled up outside Swindon Town Hall, and a vast crowd of people were staring at me.
"Hello, Thursday,"
said a familiar voice. "Lydia?" I asked, caught off guard by the sudden change of events. And so it was. But she wasn't the only TV news reporter. There were six or seven of them with their cameras trained on me as I sat sprawled inelegantly in the footwell. I struggled to get out of the car.
"This is Lydia Startright of the Toad News Network," said Lydia in her best reporter's voice. "Here with Thursday Next, the Special Ops agent responsible for saving Jane Eyre. First, let me congratulate you, Miss Next, on your successful reconstruction of the novel."
"What do you mean?" I responded. "I loused it all up. I burned Thornfield to the ground and half-maimed poor Mr. Rochester." Miss Startright laughed. "In a recent survey, 99 out of 100 readers who expressed a preference said they were delighted with the new ending. Jane and Rochester married. Isn't that wonderful?"
"But the Bronte Federation..."
"Charlotte didn't leave the book to them, Miss Next," said a man dressed in a linen suit, who had a large blue Charlotte Bronte rosette stuck incongruously to his lapel. "The Federation are a bunch of stuffed shirts. Allow me to introduce myself. Walter Bramwell, chairman of the Federation Splinter Group, Bronte for the People."
He thrust out a hand for me to shake and grinned wildly as several people nearby applauded. A battery of flash guns went off as a small girl handed me a bunch of flowers, and another journalist asked me what sort of person Rochester really was. The driver took my arm and guided me into the building.
"Colonel Phelps is waiting for you, Miss Next," murmured the man in an affable tone. The crowds parted as I was led into a large hall that was filled to capacity. I blinked stupidly and looked around. There was an excited buzz, and as I walked down the main aisle, I could hear people whispering my name. There was an improvised press box in the old orchestra pit, in which a sea of pressmen from all the major networks were seated. The meeting at Swindon had become the focus of the grassroots feeling about the war. What was said here would be highly significant. I made my way to the stage, where two tables had been set up. The two sides to the argument were clearly delineated. Colonel Phelps was sitting beneath a large English flag. His table was heavily festooned with bunting and several pot plants, flip-over pads, and stacks of leaflets for ready distribution. With him were mostly uniformed members of the armed forces who had seen service on the peninsula. All of them were willing to speak vociferously about the importance of the Crimea. One of the soldiers was even carrying the new plasma rifle. At the other end of the stage was the ante-table. This, too, was liberally populated by veterans, but none of them wore uniforms. I recognized the two students from the airship park and my brother Joffy, who smiled and mouthed, "Watcher doofus," at me. The crowd hushed. They had heard I was going to attend and had been awaiting my arrival. The cameras followed me as I approached the steps to the stage and walked calmly up. Phelps rose to meet me, but I walked on and sat down at the ante-table, taking the seat that one of the students had given up for me. Phelps was appalled. He went bright red, but checked himself when he saw that the cameras were watching his every move.
Lydia Startright had followed me onto the stage. She was there to adjudicate the meeting. It was she and Colonel Phelps who had insisted on waiting for me. Startright was glad they had. Phelps was not.
"Ladies and gentlemen," announced Lydia grandly, "the negotiating table is empty at Budapest, and the offensive lies waiting to happen. As a million troops face each other across no man's land, we ask the question, what price the Crimea?"
Phelps got up to speak, but I beat him to it. "I know it's an old joke," I began, "but a simple anagram of Crimea is a crime." I paused. "That's the way I see it, and I would defy anyone to say that it isn't. Even Colonel Phelps over there would agree with me that it's high time the Crimea was put to bed permanently." Colonel Phelps nodded. "Where the Colonel and I differ is my belief that Russia has the better claim to the territory." It was a controversial remark. Phelps's supporters were well primed, and it took 10 minutes to restore order. Startright quieted them all down and finally managed to get me to finish my point. "There was a good chance for all this nonsense to end barely 2 months ago. England and Russia were around the table, discussing terms for a complete withdrawal of all English troops." There was a hush. Phelps had leaned back in his chair and was watching me carefully. "But then along came the plasma rifle, code name Stonk." I looked down for a moment. "This Stonk was the key, the secret to a new offensive, and the possible restart of the war that has, thank God, been relatively free of actual fighting these past 8 years. But there's a problem. The offensive has been built on air. Despite all that has been said and done, the plasma rifle is a phony. Stonk does not work." There was an excited murmuring in the chamber. Phelps stared at me sullenly, eyebrow twitching. He whispered something to a brigadier who was sitting next to him. "The English troops are waiting for a new weapon that will not turn up. The Goliath Corporation have been playing the English government for a bunch of fools. Despite a £1 billion investment, the plasma rifle is about as much use in the Crimea as a broom handle." I sat down. The significance of this was not lost on anyone, either there or watching the program live. The English Minister for War was at that moment reaching for his phone. He wanted to speak to the Russians before they did anything rash, like attack. Back at the hall in Swindon, Colonel Phelps had stood up.
"Large claims from someone who is tragically ill-informed," he intoned patronizingly. "We have all seen the destructive power of Stonk, and its effectiveness is hardly the reason for this talk."
"Prove it," I responded. "I see you have a plasma rifle with you. Lead us outside to the park and show us. You can try it on me, if you so wish." Phelps paused, and in that pause he lost the argument and the war. He looked at the soldier carrying the weapon, who looked back at him nervously. Phelps and his people left the stage to barracking from the crowd. He had been hoping to give his carefully rehearsed hour-long lecture over the memory of the lost brethren and the value of comradeship. He never spoke in public again. Within 4 hours, a ceasefire had been called for the first time in 131 years. Within 4 weeks, the politicians were around the table in Budapest. Within 4 months, every single English soldier was out of the peninsula. As for the Goliath Corporation, they were soon called to account over their deceit. They expressed wholly unconvincing ignorance of the whole affair and laid the blame entirely on Jack Shit. I had hoped the corporation would be chastised further, but at least it got Goliath off my back.